This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia. Every Wednesday, we are bringing you a bonus podcast, a handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we really think is worth hearing. Of course, you can hear all of our stories, they're all worth listening to, on the full podcast we put out Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. Well, the British sci-fi master Arthur C. Clarke once remarked, "How inappropriate to call this planet Earth when clearly it is ocean." That notion underpins Richard Power's latest novel, his 14th at that, which explores what humans can learn from the underwater world, one that can seem so alien to us here on land. But that relative way of looking at the world has long been Richard's calling card. He won a Pulitzer Prize for The Overstory, an epic novel about the connected lives of trees and the threats they face. Its follow-up, Bewilderment, leaned on the cosmos for an intimate tale of how climate change weighs on children. Familiar themes abound in Playground, but in this one, Richard also riffs on how artificial intelligence is testing what it means to be human and, as the title suggests, why play is so vital. Richard Powers, wonderful opportunity to talk to you again. Hello.
Oh, hello, Pia. Thanks. I'm so pleased to be back on the show.
We're glad to have you. Anyone who's read any of your works knows that you're all about the deep dive. Beyond the plot, you've schooled us in the natural world from forest to space. And so this time you take up oceans, inspired in part by the loss of your sister, who unexpectedly passed away in 2022. I just first want to say I'm really sorry for that loss.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me what Peggy was like.
She was absolutely unpredictably delightful. She, even, you know, from the earliest age all the way to our recent years, she was endlessly playful. You mentioned that she was a direct inspiration for my taking up this topic. She gave me a book on coral reefs when I was 10. I never did understand why we were living in landlocked Chicago on the north side of the city, but the year later, my father moved us to Bangkok, Thailand, and all five of us were snorkeling and scuba diving in the South China Sea among those same coral reefs. And I think that experience changed us all. It certainly changed me. But, you know, Peg had an enormous appetite wherever we lived, and she ended up seeing a great deal of the world. She just kept me laughing and thinking and engaged, and I will thank her forever for that.
Oh, she sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
So you guys were kids and she gives you this book. Sometimes siblings give each other books and you're like, why are you giving me this?
Yeah. I think she had a little maternal thing. You know, she was 3 years older than I was, and she liked the fact that I had an omnivorous curiosity, and she was always trying to feed that. And, you know, it was like, here's a weird thing, let's give it to Ricky, you know. And I think that was the motivation behind this book. And but the upshot is that, having taken the bait, as it were, I spent the next 5 or 6 years of my childhood absolutely sure that I was going to be a marine biologist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so you're 10 years old, and do you remember, like, as a kid when you went down there, like, what did you see beyond what your eyes could see?
Yeah, it's funny because it's when you're looking at a book of vividly colored corals and you're living in a suburb of Chicago, you know, and they are psychedelic and surreal and alien and otherworldly, you just can't imagine that it's the same planet you're living on. But when they are 2 feet away from your hand, and, you know, you go out at night with lights and all the polyps are coming out, and it's a strange alien color show, it's even weirder. And there's nothing like being underwater because you're flying, you're floating effortlessly, but you can't see very far. Your whole sense of hearing is different. your entire relationship to place becomes very transient. You can't stay there very long. And all of those challenges to the senses were in my mind as I was writing this book. You know, when I wrote Overstory, which dealt so much with trees, I could step out of my house and, in short order, be among and underneath these things that I was writing about and smell them and linger and appreciate every aspect of them and take as much time with them as I wanted. When you're writing about underwater, you have to do two things that are almost contradictory. You have to make the alien world present, but you also have to keep the reader aware of the fact that we don't live there. To make something so alien vivid and personal was a great challenge in this book.
Yeah, and known to an extent.
Yeah. We know so little about the ocean. I was stunned by the statistics that I was coming across as I was reading. I mean, for one, only about a quarter of the seafloor has been mapped, so we have better maps of the moon's surface than we have of the ocean floor. But, you know, also to discover that maybe 90% of the species underwater have yet to be identified or described adequately was stunning. That means for every underwater creature that we know, there might be nine that we don't.
Yeah.
And we're discovering it in an amazing rate. 4,000 new species are inventoried every year.
Wow. So your novel captures the wonder of the seas, and it does so through four people whose lives are drawn together and forced apart, kind of like riptides. Much of the novel takes place, much of the story, on Makatea. This is a Polynesian island where a group of American investors want to build modular parts for floating cities. There's a tension between the islanders as they discuss and debate what's best for their future. What are you trying to explore in that tension?
Well, I mean, this is an island that suffered tremendously from extraction in the early part of the first half of the 20th century. It was one of the Pacific phosphate islands, and phosphate was kind of a necessary component for the huge liftoff in population of the world at that time. It could be converted into fertilizer, and it could feed this, you know, exponentially growing population. But the island suffered enormously. I mean, the extraction industry literally consumed this island that's like half the size of Manhattan. And when those phosphate mines dried up and the industries shut down, the population of the island crashed from several thousand to less than 100. Now, in the present frame of the story, the remaining islanders are presented with this choice of being this base for this seasteading enterprise for, you know, an American consortium that's looking to start the next phase of human discovery and exploitation. And part of the islanders are saying, you know, this could mean a hospital. You know, this could mean a school. Our children can stay here instead of having to go elsewhere to make a living. This could be what we need to live stably and viably and to have a future, to go into the world in a sustainable way. And the other half is saying, maybe this is just the next chapter of neocolonialism. So that's what's at stake. Now, obviously, if it's an island that's been eaten out and devastated and is slowly recovering and now has to confront the possibility of further industrialization or removal from that world, the island itself becomes a kind of microcosm for the human project. It's a classic Polynesian phrase, every island is a canoe and every canoe is an island. Well, the earth is an island, and the referendum that these people have to make is the referendum that's confronting us right now.
And the referendum we see in many, many communities as they make those choices between development and what's at stake if they do.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that was central to my mind as I was telling the story is how environmental questions have to involve the local populations, the indigenous populations, the people who are the victims and the potential beneficiaries of our relationship to the land. That proper development always has to have buy-in from the people who are there. And I think this is a pretty profound lesson for us, you know, as we confront the dual catastrophes that we're confronting right now.
I want to ask you about Todd. Todd's one of the characters, far from French Polynesia. He's a tech billionaire. He's rich. He's successful. But he also has rapidly progressing dementia, and he is exceptionally lonely. And Richard Powers, we've spoken before about your version, if I can put it that way, to capitalism and its effects on the climate crisis. And yet you're also showing a lot of empathy for Todd. Why that choice?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I've had early readers of the book say, this guy is a Silicon Valley tech bro. I thought I was supposed to hate him. But by the time I was halfway into the book, I was feeling sorry for him. I was identifying with his plight. And I think that's the secret behind powerful fiction, that we have to feel kinship even with people whose view of the world is profoundly different from ours. We have to understand the degree to which their solutions, their preferred solutions, and our preferred solutions are so deeply interdependent. So, you know, to see what might make a person pursue the things that he pursued and what's behind the desire to accumulate this great fortune, to see him with his friend of many years in this push-pull relationship, to see the way that these two boys are trying to cope with male loneliness in such different ways, is to try to put a larger lens on the question of what it is that motivates all our pursuit of meaning through accumulation.
Yeah, and you say, look, I might have become Todd, because before you were a professional writer, you studied physics and worked as a computer programmer. And you said, you've described Todd as who you would have become if you, quote, stuck with the death world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was fun to use this guy who ends up in such a profoundly different place than I did in life to be one of my two alter egos in the book. At the age of 10, he gets a book on coral reefs. He thinks he's going to be a marine scientist. When he comes of age, he falls in love with personal computers and learns how to program just as I did. He goes to the University of Illinois just as I did. But there, the paths diverge. And I actually follow the path of Todd's love-hate friend, Rafi Young, who devotes his life to literature as a different way of finding meaning. So it was almost like a private psychoanalytic session to split myself among these two characters and to feel as much sympathy for each of them, but also to show the ways in which their views of the right way of being in the world really are incommensurable.
Yeah, I like that you just said, like, suggested that you can find meaning through many different paths.
Yeah.
You can understand meaning.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to introduce one more character who's in your book. This is Evie Montrealer, thank you for that, who becomes a world-famous diver and ocean advocate. You based her in part on the real-life marine biologist Sylvia Earle. What is it about Sylvia and her life that made you want to include a character like her?
Well, Sylvia Earle is now 89, and she's still going strong. Her nickname is Her Deepness. She's such a figure in so many ways. I mean, she blazed a path in a very male-dominated world. She has written many wonderful and eloquent books and works. And she has, as much as any person alive, I think, turned our awareness to the astonishment and also the desperate conditions of the ocean. She's done it without lecturing. She's done it with her own sense of awe and wonder. I don't think I could have done justice to the themes of the book without using some aspects of Earle's biography in Evelyn's story.
I'm glad you brought up the word awe, because it is through Evie's eyes that we probably get the most palpable sense of awe about the underwater world. And you said Sylvia was like that. And it's a feeling that you're no stranger to, Richard. So why is awe so important in helping us understand the world around us, whether it's the natural world above ground or the underwater world?
Yeah, and in your question, I think, are the roots of the answer. So we are seeing the rise of this global culture that defines meaning as an entirely private and arbitrary thing, something we make by our individual selves, and that believes in a really radical individualism that is commodity mediated, that is in here, you know, that's something that the self can dictate. I think to search for awe in accumulation and in possession and privately is part of the reason why the culture as a whole has gone so far off the rails. And if you step back for a moment and say most people on Earth, in most places on Earth, for most of human history, looked for meaning in very different ways, you can start to put in opposition to that culture another exciting, reinforcing way of being in the world. So instead of individualism, you have connection, you have a vision of interdependence. Instead of human exceptionalism, you have a community of living things that are deeply imbricated and interwoven. Instead of accumulation, you have awe and you have attention. And instead of possessions, you have presence. And I think when you make that turn and you start to see that rather than the human story being the great story of life on Earth with everything else just kind of hanging on it as a little subsidiary, if you invert that and say, actually, the human story is a fairly small part of something that's much longer, much bigger, and much more important, your own life starts to get colorful and joyful and playful.
This is the Sunday Magazine, and I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. That voice that's bringing us awe today is Richard Powers. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. Richard's latest book is called Playground. Richard, a major theme that you explore in Playground is the fear of the unknown. And of course, when we're talking about what's beneath what we can see in the water, there's a great fear of that for a lot of people. But you take it beyond that. You talk about the fear of the unknown. You talk about artificial intelligence. We talk a lot about the fears of AI. This is not that kind of stereotypical evil AI that many people warn and worry about. Tell us about the AI entity in Playground.
Yeah, you know, fear is a big motivator for all the characters in the book, and it's generally a fear of the unknown. And my choice was to make Todd and Rafi born in the year 1970. So as they're young children, they make this turn that all of us who lived through those years had to make, which is from the pre-digital world, primarily analog, to the digital world. So, you know, they're just seeing the first personal computers come into their lives. And at every step, it was intriguing to me to say, what is the relationship between fear and excitement as the world is changing at this exponential rate and bringing in these entities whose impact on the way that we live, whose impact on our brains and our personalities and our psyches we can't foresee? And to watch these characters, you know, for instance, in their college years, see the very first web browser and their reactions of, you know, perplexity or confusion or indifference or mild excitement, you know, that failed to understand the ways in which this technology was going to completely take over their lives. And following those people up to the present and this truly unprecedented way, in some senses, in which new entities are going to come into the world, is to show that this process of accommodating technological changes has been present in all our lives for a long time, but is now venturing into territory where the stakes are so much larger and the entities themselves are so much harder to imagine and wrap our heads around.
And this is why you're more hopeful about it, right? You have this line in the book that says the age of humans was coming to an end. A new kind of life had come along to take our jobs, manage our industries, make our new discoveries, be our friends, and fix our society as it saw fit. And I think that it saw fit is the part that scares so many people about AI. But you're just what you said there. You're just more hopeful about it.
I don't know. My relationship to hope is very mercurial. And I think I have no hope that we will be living in the way that we're living right now in another generation. And I don't necessarily think that that's a good thing to hope for, because I think there are many things about the way that we live now that are simply crazy and can't be sustained. I have infinite amount of hope that life that is constantly responding to cataclysm at the same rate that it has always responded to cataclysm, that's constantly evolving and playing with new solutions and possibilities, that life will survive whatever we throw at it. What I think the open-ended question is, can we be part of that ongoing story in a meaningful and productive way? And that's where I think hope in the abstract, has to give way to commitment. It has to give way to a desire to work for the rehabilitation of the world. Now, the same things that make us fearful can also make us hopeful. So digital culture moves orders of magnitude faster than the baseline culture before we brought these things into the world. But oddly, that rapidity might be our ace in the hole. What we need to do is take control of cultural institutions and societal mores and use our nimbleness and our flexibility and our speed, the ability to move quickly in the world, to start to address this accumulation of impact that we have left in the living world. I am hopeful that human ingenuity will come up with the solutions that we need to continue to survive, to play the infinite game. I have a more qualified hope that we will be wise enough or that we will have the social institutions or the cultural wisdom to bring about those changes.
People can look at the same issues that you look, whether they be, technological instability, climate change, colonialism, you name it. The themes in your writing mirror some of the greatest challenges and anxieties we face in the real world. So you and someone else can look at the same world. And yet, Richard, you don't have a naivete or a Pollyanna-ish look at it, but you do have this optimism. You exude optimism. You have faith in us humans and our future in some way. Where does your sense of optimism come from?
I think when you look at human history, you can see that anxiety, you know, hangs heavy on us in all historical epochs. Now, you can also step back and say the stakes are higher than ever and the affordances are graver than they have ever been. And the point is, I think, that the desires that go into making these machines, whatever it is that we're looking for from them, stories can get to and understand and can find ways of turning them productive. So, you know, my pragmatic realization when I write a book like this is, you know, everybody knows how grim the moment is and how quickly time is running out on so many aspects of this incredible planet. But everybody also knows how powerful we are when we realize the stakes. And to tell a fiction that is potentially accurate, but that paralyzes us with a sense of how much damage has been done, is simply less useful than to tell a fiction that says there might be ways of being in the world that are joyful and productive, whatever their practical outcome. Mm. So I look for the stories that make a person feel, after they've turned that last page, more invested, more present, more attentive, and with more energy to go back into the world and engage it.
Of course, the book is called Playground with an emphasis on play. Play is present in all of these characters' lives. You, Richard, drew inspiration from Homo Ludens. This is a 1938 book, which argued that play is older than civilization. I remember once hearing someone on the radio or something who said, you know, it's interesting, we humans, the first, 10 years of our lives, the central focus, one of them is about play. And then we just simply like seem to abandon it, like it had no worth. So why is play so important in both nature and humanity?
Yeah. Let me start by saying certain kinds of play disappear from our lives as we age, and they can be replaced by other kinds of play that are sometimes hugely salubrious, sometimes a little bit more nefarious. So, you know, we play music and we play with words, we play with ideas, we play with possibilities, we play the stock market, we put on plays. And as adults, we like to play God. So there are all kinds of ways that we keep doing things inside this, you know, what Johann Huizinga called the magic circle. We know the world, we arm ourselves, we mature, we grow, we anticipate, and we respond to the changing world by making these imaginative spaces that then, you know, allow us, with a given set of rules, to test out our ability to respond flexibly. So some of the games we play as adults have gone awry. But I don't think there's anything in being older that can't be revived by the kind of play in childhood that leads to awe, that leads to wonder.
I want to go back to where we started from just before I let you go. And this is about Peggy, who gave you that book when you were 10 and she was 13.
Yeah.
And you talked about her just being an observer of the world and knew you had an appetite that for all kinds of wonder that really couldn't be satiated, but she tried by giving you all these books and so on and so forth. Mm. What do you think Peggy would have thought about Playground? Not the book itself, but the ideas you sort of explore.
Yeah, I think she would have found ways of teasing me about it. She would have found ways of playing with it herself. Yeah, her spirit is so much in the book that I hope in some ways it continues the game of her life.
It's a beautiful book. Once again, I feel like I say that to you every time I talk to you, but it really is. And
it
widens our minds to read you, Richard Powers. Thank you so much, as always.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. See you next time.
Yep. See you next time. Richard Powers is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. His new book is called Playground. And you can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine by heading to our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thanks for lending us your ear. We'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.